In this episode, Sib Subanda and Paul Kim discuss Dorothy Sayers' third proposition, which is that the worker's first duty is to serve the work, not the community. Her view is that whenever man is made the centre of things, trouble follows, and that is the problem with making serving the community the purpose of work.
Welcome to Reframed. Join us as we explore the concept of redemptive business in our unique contexts on the African continent.
Hello and welcome to part five of the Why Work podcast series based on Dorothy Sayers' essay. It's good to be back, and with me as always is Paul Kim. Hey, Paul.
Hi, Sibs. Almost at the finish line.
Indeed. So by way of recap, then, we've looked at the first two propositions that Sayers put forward in her essay. The first one being that work is not primarily a thing one does to live, but the thing one lives to do. And the second being that it's the business of the church to recognize that the secular vocation is as such sacred. So today we're going to turn our attention to her third and final proposition, which she states as follows: the worker's first duty is to serve the work. Quite an unusual idea, isn't it? But I think you'll find as we unpack this essay, we're going to see some very useful insights into the biblical perspective on work. But before we listen to today's reading, I know that Paul's mind is always ticking and he always has some residual thoughts after our discussions. Paul, anything to get off your chest before we get going?
Yeah, I think I'll keep today's second bite of the apple short, and it's about this idea that our economy is based on scarcity. When there are a few people relative to the resources available, an economy of scarcity looks like it's working because you haven't hit the limitations of your resources yet. The point is very simple. If an economy is based on scarcity and not abundance, it will be preoccupied with gatekeeping and not unlocking more value from the natural upper limit of the physical environmental constraints. Some of this is related to what economists call externalities, where the cost of producing a good is not captured into its value price mechanism. Think junk food or environmentally unfriendly manufacturing processes. At some point, this collapses on itself. And in a country like South Africa, the symptoms of this process are becoming very clear in the healthcare space. You can't really grow an economy based on sick people. And the healthcare industry makes money off of sick people. The more sick people there are, the more money the healthcare industry makes. So there's a natural limit to what they're able to do. Anyway, enough for now. And I hope the listeners can ask to expand this a little bit more in episode six, where we can get listener engagement.
All right, Paul. So let's turn our attention to today's reading of Dorothy Sayers' essay, Why Work?
This brings me to my third proposition, and this may sound to you the most revolutionary of all. It is this: the worker's first duty is to serve the work. The popular catchphrase of today is that it is everybody's duty to serve the community, but there is a catch in it. It is the old catch about the two great commandments: love God and your neighbor. On those two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. The catch in it, which nowadays the world has largely forgotten, is that the second commandment depends upon the first, and that without the first, it is a delusion and a snare. Much of our present trouble and disillusionment have come from putting the second commandment before the first. If we put our neighbor first, we are putting man above God, and that is what we have been doing ever since we began to worship humanity and make man the measure of all things. Whenever man is made the center of things, he becomes the storm center of trouble, and that is precisely the catch about serving the community. There are three very good reasons for this. A. The first is that you cannot do good work if you take your mind off the work to see how the community is taking it, any more than you can make a good drive from the tee if you take your eye off the ball. Blessed are the single-hearted, for that is the real meaning of the word we translate the pure in heart. If your heart is not wholly in the work will not be good. And work that is not good serves neither God nor the community. It only serves mammon. B. The second reason is that the moment you think of serving other people, you begin to have a notion that other people owe you something for your pains. You begin to think that you have a claim on the community. You will begin to bargain for reward, to angle for applause, and to harbor a grievance if you are not appreciated. But if your mind is set upon serving the work, then you know you have nothing to look for. The only reward the work can give you is the satisfaction of beholding its perfection. C. And thirdly, if you set out to serve the community, you will probably end by merely fulfilling a public demand, and you may not even do that. A public demand is a changeable thing. The work has been falsified to please the public, and in the end, even the public is not pleased. The only true way of serving the community is to be truly in sympathy with the community, to be oneself part of the community, and then to serve the work without giving the community another thought. Then the work will endure because it will be true to itself. It is the work that serves the community. The business of the worker is to serve the work. Where we have become confused is in mixing up the ends to which our work is put with the way in which the work is done. The end of the work will be decided by our religious outlook. As we are, so we make. It is the business of religion to make us Christian people, and then our work will naturally be turned to Christian ends, because our work is the expression of ourselves.
Okay, so in case you missed it, here's a reminder of Sarah's third proposition. She says the worker's first duty is to serve the work. Now, before we explore this rather counterintuitive idea, let's start by clarifying what she means by serving the work. How would you explain it, Paul?
I think it's perhaps helpful to engage this phrase in the context of the whole, which is that we are to serve the work and the work is to serve the community. Then the easiest mental model for me is to think of it as a machine that produces some sort of product that is valued by a specific customer. More specifically, imagine that you're not allowed to touch the product directly at any point in time, and you can only engage with the product indirectly through the machine. So if you want to build a better product, you would need to build a better machine. So to serve the work is then to make the machine better, and the work to serve the community would be then the product that the machine produces to serve the customer. It's a crude picture, but I think it gets across the point. In reality, however, we are part of the quote-unquote machine that produces the goods. Our intellect, skills, expertise, intuition, etc. are core parts of the production process that produce the valued product. This then should bring to the serving of the work a perspective that we highlighted in the Monday Christian series, that God is the creator of all work. He created the fundamental building blocks of work, and we get to discover it and create structure to the knowledge in a way that allows us to use it in the creation of value. And so again, I use this verse a lot, Proverbs 25:2, it is the glory of God to conceal a thing, but the honor of kings is to search out the matter. If he created all the fundamentals of work, then I think we can safely assume a couple of things. Because he is infinite, there is potentially infinite depth to the work that needs to be done. Because he is purposeful, each discipline he has created or fundamental building block of knowledge has a specific purpose in his creation. And because his creation is a complex, interdependent system of subsystems, I suspect the disciplines or the building blocks work together in a similar fashion. Serving the work is then a desire to unearth the purpose and deliver on the promise of any given discipline or fundamental building block for the flourishing of all of creation. Now, this, of course, doesn't mean that it will, and humans can use these gifts to rather create their own proverbial Tower of Babel. And the quickest route to that, in my opinion, is to base your work decisions on your lifestyle needs, because it's got nothing to do with the work. We distort the end goal of our work if we make it about remuneration and lifestyle or the community, and the focus of this specific episode. Another way of thinking about this, to highlight the error of putting lifestyle and remuneration first, going back to the episode before, is, you know, if you're in the business, it's very easy to want to support your lifestyle. But imagine you had to replace yourself. How much would you pay the person that you needed to replace yourself in the business? And a very different answer typically comes up. Because then you're thinking more about the business and the needs of the business as opposed to your needs as an individual and your family's needs.
Very good point, Paul. And I just want to double click on that because as we've been preparing for this, and I've been thinking about this in the course of my own work, and this idea of serving the work is actually a really powerful idea. So I just want to maybe earth it a bit more as well in the creation mandate. So in Genesis chapter 1, so his instruction in Genesis 1:28 and 2:15 to take care of and develop presupposes that he already had in mind the different types of work that would be involved in fulfilling that mandate, such as, for example, agriculture, mining, education, business, arts, entertainment, and so on. And so, although the Bible is not a book about education per se, or business, or the arts, we do find biblical, or what we might call creational norms, which govern the proper function of each of those spheres. So, for example, one that perhaps we can all relate to, the fact that God made us unique means that our approach to education must not be rigid, as though all children learn in exactly the same way. So again, the Bible is not teaching us about education, but we learn from the fact, the way that God made us, that should influence and impact directly the way we educate children. And with respect to business, for example, the fact that God created human beings in his own image means that our HR policies, for example, should reinforce human dignity, irrespective of race, gender, education, etc., enabling flourishing for all stakeholders. And so by serving the work, I believe says is simply referring to approaching any type of work in line with its creational intent to bring about the flourishing of human beings and the natural world. And when it's done in this way, I'll give you a couple of examples. The legal profession then will protect the rights of citizens, holding lawbreakers to account, protecting victims of lawlessness, because that's the creational intent of law. The food industry, for example, will supply the best possible quality of food at fair prices. Banking and insurance will facilitate the responsible risk-taking that is essential for economic growth. And we could go on. And all of these outcomes, and here's the point, are in keeping with the cultural mandate. And to the degree that the worker, whether they're Christian or not, aims at achieving these and other God-intended outcomes in a manner consistent with God's order, Christians wouldn't necessarily call it God's order. They might refer to it as, say, natural law. So to the degree that one is doing that in a manner consistent with God's order, he or she can be said to be serving the work.
Yes, I wholeheartedly agree. And might I add, and to connect the dots to some of our previous episodes, what does remuneration and lifestyle have to do with our ability to serve the work? A remarkable aspect of humankind is the unbelievable efficiency of our design. I remember watching a documentary a couple of years ago called AlphaGo, which documents the historic win by a computer over a human in the game of Go. Unlike chess, Go is orders of magnitude more complex, and the traditional brute force methods used by computers to beat humans at chess hasn't and won't work. DeepMind, a Google company these days, is a machine learning, AI, choose your popular description of the day company, took a different technique, and for the first time in history, a computer was able to beat a human. This was back in 2017, if I recall correctly. And not just any human, the highest ranking Go player at that time, and I think the score was 4.5 to 0.5, so one draw. Now, it was an amazing feat of human ingenuity, see what I did there, to create a machine that could quote-unquote teach itself Go and continue learning at such a tremendous speed. However, the crazy thing was that if you looked at it from a cost perspective, just on the consumption to keep the thing going, it was incomparable. A human brain draws about 20 watts, not enough to power up a normal light bulb in a household. And it's just ridiculously low. AlphaGo required 50,000 times more electricity and a lot of very smart brains and scientific progress to beat one human being operating on enough energy to light up an energy-efficient LED light bulb. That is remarkable. And the reason why I bring this up is that those of us that earn more or seemingly need a more extravagant lifestyle and bring it into the considerations of our work in order to do good work, these are not required to do better work. It's not like some of us have brains that draw 1 kilowatt of power. Now, I'm obviously simplifying the idea significantly, and it's very crude, I know. But 20 watts of power is all that it needs to run the human brain. There is no need for Wagyu steak, gold flakes in sparkling water, and caviar to run the human brain. Rice and beans is more than adequate. And we see this anecdotally. Genius does and can come from poverty, even though we structure society against it. Imagine a world where we do the opposite.
And just double click on that, Paul. What exactly do you mean by the opposite in this context?
Well, if you think about the way we've built our economy, again, this idea of building our economy on scarcity, where we gatekeep professions, by the training that they need to go to, the amount of money that you would need to even enter the training, the lifestyle experiences that you need to be even eligible, we really have stuck the odds against those who come from nothing or those that don't have much to becoming senior leaders of industry in our population. And yet we're all humans. We all need 20 watts of power. And the people that come through the ranks, that come from poverty and make it, I mean, that's just an exception to the norm. The norm is, unless you come through the traditional ranks and your parents have done well and can give you an opportunity, you just don't stand a chance. How many more amazing individuals would be unearthed if we saw this as an exercise in unearthing as much talent from the human population as possible, instead of gatekeeping specific professions or specific roles for the benefit of a few?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And what I like about the point you made earlier, just talking about how our ability to serve the work is not linked directly to remuneration, is that I think one of the criticisms of the faith and work, well, in quotes, movement, for lack of a better word, it's not really a movement, it's just application of the gospel to life. But one of the criticisms is that it's very white collar, right? So it's aimed at CEOs and business leaders and all of that sort of thing, and you know, people who are, quote, upstream, right? And it's not a very blue collar message, but I think the point you're making earlier is that the call to serve the work is not one for people with these massive high paying jobs, right? It's for the CEO as much as it is for the guy who's waking up to make good tables, to refer back to Dorothy Sayers' essay, and that it's something that every believer can wake up and determine to do every Monday morning. Not so?
Yes, I wholeheartedly agree. And part of it is this, and it's not everywhere in the world, but definitely in a country like South Africa where blue-collar work is looked down on, we don't believe there's depth to the work. It's just put a person in the job and he can do it, and there's just a standard level of output. And I want to maybe use two examples. Like I work with a lot of farmers, and I'm aware of some of their labor practices, using a lot of seasonal labor, some of those being foreign workers. And the productivity levels typically of the foreign worker are significantly higher than the South African worker. This is not skilled labor. This is picking blueberries or picking apples. How is that possible, that the migrant laborer is able to perform 80 to 100% more productive than the South African worker? There must be a depth to their work if that is possible. And so there should be a desire, even at a blue-collar worker level, to say, I can do excellent work if I strive to want to do it. But again, in our society, we've looked down on blue-collar work, and so it's not something that one becomes better at. Another example, and I've used it before, is maybe I'll take a different angle here. On YouTube, go look up the fastest workers in the world. And it's typically blue-collar workers, whether it's a waiter that is cleaning up a table afterwards or setting the table, to someone who's throwing gas bottles onto the back of a truck. Guys, this is ridiculous. Just go look at the technique and the skill and the efficiency with which these blue-collar workers are applying the trade, and tell me that blue collar work is mundane. It's unbelievable what is possible when you think of work as something that you can excel at, irrespective of the type of work that you do. And the faith in work movement, potentially because it's aimed at a white collar workforce and it comes from, let's call it, more academic stance or theological stance, it hasn't done enough to speak to the blue collar workforce. And that's something that I hope in the next generation gets articulated much better.
Yeah, I mean, I was just listening to someone on YouTube who was talking about how, just reflecting on their career and why they left the legal profession, and just saying how their brain works fast, right? It was Ben Shapiro, I think it was, and I think he's not so much a 20 watt brain. I think he's a 60 watt or 80 watt brain, close to yours, Paul. But you know, and he was talking about how this whole idea of billing by the hour. And so the problem that he ran into was because he did his work so quickly, the billable hours were low. And so there was this pressure to increase the hours and slow down the work. So to your point, sometimes it's actually white collar work is actually structured to intentionally go slowly. So anyway, let's move. Let's turn our attention now to this distinction, because I think this is the crux of her proposition. This distinction that she appears to draw between serving the work and serving the community, because if anything, serving the community sounds like the more biblical of the two. After all, we are called to love our neighbor as ourselves, right? And work is one of the greatest platforms that we have for doing that. So, Paul, why this distinction, and why does Sayers appear to downplay serving the community?
Well, I think the key to understanding her statement is that it's about putting the second commandment before the first, putting the love for neighbor or of neighbor ahead of love for God. I think we mentioned a similar idea about taking remuneration as the key indicator for choosing a job. It inherently assumes that the way in which the world values different types of work is right, which we know is flawed reasoning. Thus, putting the community as your North Star assumes they know best, which is not always the case. And we don't have to go too far back in history to see that. Dorothy's own example of Hitler and the justice system is bone-chilling. Hitler was admonishing the justice system to serve the needs of Germany instead of serving the needs of justice. The entire processed food industry and how it's evolved to is just one example of this, pandering to the whims of its customers who want convenience and superficial taste experiences. Canada's line on hard drugs and the ensuing mess that seems to be spilling out into their cities is another example. We also have secondary issues to this idea of putting the community first. Like, which community are we referencing? Because not all communities are alike. And the community is just a single stakeholder in creation. I think Dorothy Sayers in the earlier part of the essay was talking about the hunger of labor that keeps the economic machine of productive waste going. And it's also relevant here, creating jobs at the expense of the environment and even our own health. Now, having said that, there's a reason why we need to be careful. And I think I differ here with Dorothy, although the line is a bit thinner for me. I agree with her in principle, but I think she went too far, and perhaps she did it in the context of an era where Hitler was abusing the justice system for his own gains. I think the biblical point is more that love for community is centered on love for God, but without it, it becomes a major problem. But you don't throw away love for neighbor just because of the risk. It's the same with truth. Truth not centered on God or love can be harsh, unloving, egotistical, power-mongering, but you don't throw away truth. And that's what some Christians have done in response to the concern of using truth incorrectly. It's truth and love. There's an interesting philosophical question about perception and observation that perhaps illustrates the thinness of that line for me. And it goes like this. If a tree falls in a forest and no one is around to hear it, does it make a sound? Basically, if a sound isn't heard, then is there a sound? In a similar vein, if work is done but not utilized, is it really work? Or is it as good a work as it could be? So if a house is built but no one lives in it, is it work? If a master bricklayer builds an incredible and sophisticated house but no one lives in it, is it more valuable to humankind than a simple house built by an amateur bricklayer that houses a family of five?
Okay, just let's hold on a second, Paul. Let me jump in there if I may, because I think those questions are worth probing. So if I'm hearing you correctly, you're questioning whether working well is of any value if there are no beneficiaries of the work? Or to use Sayers' language, is it meaningful to serve the work if that work does not serve the community? Is that correct?
Yes, I'm saying that's one of the key questions one must ask. I'm not saying it's the only one, right? So I'm using this as an example to illustrate the point of how tricky it is practically to do what Dorothy says, which is to kind of ignore the community, right? She says something along the lines of having full sympathy with the community and then not thinking twice about them again when proceeding with the work. Now, I think the deliberation that ensues is very difficult, and the line between sympathy with the community and serving the community is much thinner than what she makes it out to be. In Christian circles, the opposite danger often surfaces when people say they have a direct relationship with Jesus and don't need the church. Another way of talking about this in church circles is the tension that they sit with when thinking about spreading the gospel, evangelism, and social justice. And with many churches just, you know, taking one as more important than the other. But those two are inseparable. The caution being that social justice must be centered on the gospel. It's not an either or. And in this case, loving neighbor must be done, but on the centered on loving God. And I think the way she phrases it, and again, if she was here, I'd love to ask her more, it sounds like it's kind of throwing it away completely, and I'm not so sure that's helpful.
Okay, so let me ask you a question then. So as we're both in the IT space, I'll give you an example in our field. So suppose you build software that you believe will revolutionize access to debt in the blue-collar market, okay? As a redemptive business leader, you've identified predatory lending practices that take advantage of the financially illiterate as an undesirable distortion of sin in that particular industry. And your software not only makes good business sense for your investors, but if successful, will foster responsible access to debt for blue-collar workers. And so you spend 2 years in research and development, and you go around and you interview thousands of stakeholders on sort of both sides of the equation to ensure that your software will actually take into account everyone's needs and concerns. Okay, so you've put in 2 hours of diligent, hard work that is looking to serve these respective communities. Now, if after all of that hard work,
right? Because right? 2 hours is probably insufficient.
Did I say 2 hours?
Yes.
Wrong industry. 2 years. So if after all of that hard, diligent labor, your product is rejected by the market, right? In other words, it never actually gets to serve the community. Can we deduce then by that single metric that it was of no value at all? And the reason I'm asking is simple, but I think quite profound. Because there's a lot of work in many different industries, not just ours, that has to be undertaken at risk. Risk that it will be rejected by the intended stakeholder community. So we're in a situation like that right now, my business partner and I. So we develop software, custom software solutions. We've got one of our anchor clients and was coming up to renewal of their contract. So we did exactly what I've just described. We 2 months in leading up to the renewal, we sat down and had interviews, stakeholder interviews, all of the different business units, and what did everybody need out of the software in the following year, and what challenges were they facing, et cetera, et cetera. And we brought all of that into the development of our scope. Okay, and so we developed the scope, and from the scope, we went on and gave them put down a proposal that was really reflecting back to them their own needs. Okay, so we were diligent and we were doing our best to serve them. So then just a couple of days ago, we got from someone who hadn't even read the proposal, who had just been sort of slapped on as head of IT, just said, oh yeah, no, by the way, we're moving off this, one of our products, we're moving off this system and we're going to that system because of X, Y, and Z, da, da, da. And you know, he opened the proposal and said, oh, well, what does this mean? Oh, I don't understand. It was very casual about a piece of work that we had spent 2 months developing. Okay. So what does this mean then for the way we approach such work that is done at risk? If by your logic, work is only valuable to the degree that it actually serves the community, where does Paul's admonition in Colossians 3:23 come into play, where he says that we should work at whatever we do with all our hearts, which my business partner and I felt that we did, because we're working for the Lord and not people. And what about the fact that God uses our work to work on us? So the sanctifying value of the to the worker, with or without direct benefit to the community. What would you say about that?
Sure. Those are all valid examples. And that one, by the way, is heartbreaking, and I'm really sorry to hear that. But for each one of the examples that you could pull up, I'm sure we can also pull up some inventors that created some thingy-majig that was basically useless if the investor or the inventor spent a significant amount of time and effort during the innovation process. In a similar vein, you can't take a single metric of effort to say that was great work, right? And I think that's the point I'm trying to say. I think to determine whether, and we can talk about it a little bit later on, to determine whether something is great work is a multifaceted question. And I think Dorothy says too quickly throws away the community in that analysis. The world is a fallen place. We spoke about it in one of our previous episodes. The curse on work means that great work may not be rewarded. So it might even be great work, but not rewarded, which in this case may even include being implemented. So it's not even about being paid. It's about being used. Excellence, I think, is contextual. What constituted a good car in 1950 is different from the definition of a good car today, just to illustrate the point of what I mean by it's contextual. Additionally, and here's maybe the answer to your specific situation, and by the way, it's very close to my heart, because I did spend 5 years thinking about how to build a system for the blue-collar worker debt situation, and I never got to actually implement the final vision thereof. So it hurts. I understand that pain. But one can do great work in one discipline, but do bad work in the whole. So in your example, I could have created a fantastic system, but a poor quality business. And that is the difficulty of business, because how to balance the different components required in a business to succeed and know how to spread your resources between them. Another angle of consideration that makes this discussion more robust is that of cost. Like, how important is what the community can or is willing to pay for something a key determinant of success? And another example here would be that of making a knife. What does it mean to make the best knife if not to take into account the application thereof, which is centered on the community and the way in which they would use the knife? Now, we can easily have a longer discussion about the impact of the fall, which we started, which is, you know, good work may not be rewarded. And there's obviously a tricky analysis to do there. But in essence, what I'm asking is, if our work doesn't actually lead to loving our neighbor, is it actually work? And this is a fundamental assumption that I have made and proposed on Monday Christian. Work is an act of love for neighbor, or act of love for God and neighbor. Work is worship to God as we love our neighbor. I think Dorothy would say that it doesn't matter, again, reading from her essay and not being able to discuss it with her. And all I'm saying is, I think we need to spend a bit more time thinking about it before we make the call.
I think we might be on different sides of that line, Paul, if I'm hearing you correctly, right? Because you seem to be suggesting that we should determine the validity of our work by extrapolating the use to which it will be put by the community, or that it may be put by the community, which presents the immediate problem that in a world distorted by sin, it should be our expectation that any work, however noble our intentions, will not always result in expressions of love for people. In fact, often it will be used against people to manipulate people, subjugate, et cetera, et cetera. So going back to your example of a knife. So should we not make good knives for fear that people might stab each other, right? If I make a knife blunt as a Christian, I'm a Christian knife maker, I make my knives blunt. Why? Well, you know, in case someone tries to stab someone, you know, then they won't die. What? Or take something that's overtly designed for serving the community, like life insurance, right? A story came out a few years ago, a female police officer in South Africa who systematically, and I know it's hard to believe, but she systematically took out life policies on her own relatives, and then over time had them murdered one by one to cash in on those policies. She raked in about 800,000 rand before she was caught. So there again, you have a product that was intended to serve the community being used to destroy the community. So don't you think that from a redemptive perspective, serving the work involves mitigating as far as possible against the destructive use of our products and services by that community who we fully expect to abuse? So in the insurance example, writing life policies in such a way that schemes such as I've just described would be increasingly difficult to pull off. And in some cases, this will require multi-sector approach, such as guns, for example. And I know in the US, that's a hot topic, where, for example, gun manufacturers can work hard, so can serve the work hard at improving their products in the full knowledge that legislators who are in a different sector will pass laws that will protect the community from self-harm. And law enforcement in a different sector would use those same products to enforce such laws and protect citizens from their improper use, again, as far as possible. Don't you think that's more a redemptive and realistic approach to what we're talking about?
Yes, and I love it. I agree with everything that you've said. You know, design needs to take into account a fallen man, a sinful heart. And just out of interest, the insurance example, it's actually the example that you raised is a story of unintended consequences, because one of the key principles of life insurance, at least, is insurable interest. Like, I can't take out an insurance policy on the king's life, right? It needs to be directly related to you. It's going to have an impact on you if that person dies. Otherwise, we start taking bets on everyone else, right? Everyone else's life. And in this case, instead of preventing that, it's actually pushed this person to then take out a policy on a loved one, which is not intended to do, but because that's the only way she can fix the system, she's done that. And so it's, you know, the original principle has driven her even deeper into her fallenness, which is frightening. So there's a story there about, you know, at some point, the fallenness or the sinfulness of man's heart is greater than any design that we can come up with. But Sips, that wasn't the point I was making. And I love the fact that you talk about a sharpened knife, because I can think of at least one knife that you wouldn't want very sharp, or two. The one is a butter knife.
Which is?
A butter knife. A butter knife is not intended to be incredibly sharp. A kid's a toy knife is not intended to be incredibly sharp. And my point was more not the quality of the work, but the way in which a knife would be used. And that's what I was more bringing out. How do you divorce great work from the community in as simple as fashion as Dorothy as stating in her essay? And again, I wish she was here so we can speak to her some of the examples and get her feedback.
Okay, Paul, I'm going to cut us off right there because I want to move to just one more question before we land this thing. So in Andrew Crouch's book, Culture Making, he says that culture is what we make of the world. But before we can become culture makers, we must be culture keepers. We must be those who have learned the skills required of their craft and can participate in it with excellence and maturity. He gives the example that in order to serve theater making, we must make the effort to know its history, its techniques, its worth, and only then can we know how to serve it as a cultural product. So talk to us briefly about the importance of excellence in mastering our respective fields as redemptive business leaders.
Here's some initial thoughts or assumptions that I make before I get to answering your question. So I've got three and then some bullet points. So firstly, I think it's inherent in our creational mandate to have excellence as our North Star. I say North Star because it's a never-ending journey that must be navigated with wisdom, that core example that I used earlier. If we are co-workers with God and have the ability to reflect on our work and say that it is good, as God has done at the beginning, then we need to be able to look at our work to reflect on and cast judgment to some extent, whether it's good or bad, and then obviously aim for what God would or what God's character points towards, because you know he looked at his work as good. And we would want to reflect that in our image of godness to look at our work and say that it's good. So if we're doing bad work, then we should want to improve it. Second, I think I think excellence biblically has serious contextual considerations. What I mean with that is excellence is not a standalone, absolute assessment. So if God looked at all of his creation and said that it was very good, so all of it, and in the context of humans, very good, it's quite clear that these designs are good in their context. A fish can't fly, but that doesn't make its design bad. For its intended purpose, it's good. And so our definition of excellence must take into account contextual considerations. And I find this very important to maybe highlight for our Christian brothers and sisters, because, you know, you walk into a shop, it may be a little bit dirty and so on and so forth. And, you know, you're operating on a completely different level. And then you cast judgment immediately and say, this is not excellent. But, you know, you've got your millions or hundreds of millions that you can throw at a problem where they don't have the same luxury. We have to be able to have nuance in determining what is excellent work and not, for its intended objective. And so that requires a more nuanced assessment of the work. And three, I think biblical excellence is only possible with grace. Modern innovation practices are good anecdotes for what I'm about to say here, which is that if there's no margin for error, then real innovation isn't possible. If there is too much fear in failing, real substantial shifts in perspective of what excellence looks like is just not possible. Is it any wonder why God created so much redundancy in the world? He knew we would make so many and serious mistakes that he needed to create a world that could absorb and bounce back from our many, many mistakes. There's grace built into the world. And so coming to your actual question then, is I think to seek excellence is what it means to be made in the image of God. To seek excellence in this world gives us a seat at the table to not only share our faith and our life with other human beings, but to also show that the God of the world, the creator of the universe, is the creator of the universe. If we're becoming more like him or wanting to be more like him and manifest himself into our work, and that produces excellent work, that speaks volumes to people that are interested in table making but do not have faith in God, or interested in the design of financial products but do not have faith in God. I'm actually in an interesting position at the moment. I've served 5 years in the farm worker community, and it was really rough there. And you could say, in many respects, no visible progress. And you could easily say or question whether this was excellent work. I am now consulting to a large financial services company where the ideas that I'm bringing to the table and the work that was done at the previous company has huge merit and is very welcomed and is very fresh. And it's because that business that I was involved in earlier, a lot of the thinking was done from God's perspective, taking into account in the original intent behind loans and savings and all of those things, taking into account the fallenness of man, that people often act against their own long-term interests. And out of those convictions, fundamentally new products and services and ideas in a very old industry has emerged. And I was able to bring that to the table, and they were very welcome. And so the point being, excellence is a way of being able to engage with the world and to engage with non-Christians, without which we just don't have a voice.
Yeah, that's a very good point to make there, Paul. And just as you were saying that, I was thinking about how sometimes as Christians in business, we can be very one-dimensional in our understanding of excellence. And so, give you an example, we've got a client who does installations. I won't say what type. Certain types of installation, and so they're very, as part of their worship to God, they're very excellent in the technical aspect of their work. And so, you know what it's like with installations. A lot of things are hidden behind boxes, and so you just kind of normally just have wires done, however, and just slap a box on it to make it look nice. But these guys make a lot of effort to, even the hidden stuff is done well to a very high standard. Right. But here's the thing, you know, the questions around how long it takes for them to respond, or promises that are made, will be there tomorrow, maybe they're there next week, or How do the employees feel about working for the company and all of these other things? So the excellence, I think it's understanding that there's excellence in your field, but there's excellence in running a business as well, right? And that it's no good being excellent in one thing, but in the technical aspects of your work, but not expanding to the way you deal with customers, for example, because it's all part of the same work, part of that same ecosystem. And it's part of the problem as well with measuring ourselves by ourselves, right? Because you talk to Christians in business and they'll say, oh yeah, no, we do things well because X, Y, and Z, but no one is really asking questions about those other aspects, or we're not inviting questions. And so it's really a plug for community in this pursuit of doing business in a way that glorifies God. And for those of you who are new to Ziwani, I just want to just do a plug for our community group, so you can get onto our website, ziwani.com. This is not just about putting out good content. It's about connecting us with good people as well, connecting us with other business leaders who are facing the same challenges you are and are grappling with the same things from a biblical perspective. And so I really want to encourage you to jump onto the website and see and get connected in one of our online groups where you can walk with others in trying to glorify God through business. So Paul, we have unfortunately come to the end, but before I lock the door, any final thoughts?
To support kind of how these two work together, serving the work and leading the works of the community, my assumption is that God must have imbued in the work a natural way in which the work would serve the community. That's the only way, Dorothy says, comment makes sense. This is, of course, assuming that the first question she poses about what work should be done is answered wisely. And I actually wish she spent a lot more time, another 4 or 5 pages in the essay, to deal with that first. Because I think she says it and then she moves on with it. But it's such a critical question, especially in our day and time, where there's so many options for what type of work we do. Anyway, so just a thought that I've been chewing through. These podcasts are both terrifying and exciting, a burden and a joy. And now that we're at the end of the prepared part of the series, with one more to go, I'm glad we've done it. And my brain and soul feel like they've had a serious session at the gym. And I really do hope that it's been helpful, fruitful thought for our audience and for you, Sips.
Well, audience, thank you so much for following the Why Work series. Again, if you'd like to share any comments or questions, please do so by emailing me at sibs@mergon.co.za, and we'll do our best to respond to all of your questions. We also hope to invite a couple of you to join us for a discussion based on your reflections and questions throughout the series. We see it as a great way to encourage engagement, but also to further help you and indeed ourselves with the practical application of the theology presented. We hope you really enjoyed and benefited from this series. For now, it's goodbye and God bless.
Cheers, everyone.
Thank you for joining us. This episode of Reframed was brought to you by Ziwani, a community of business leaders who partner together to live out their kingdom calling in the marketplace within Africa. Ziwani is a Mergon initiative. To know more about us, visit our website at ziwani.com. That's ZIWANI.com.